Well, good morning. Good to see all of you. There's a hypothesis in theology known as the documentary hypothesis. I wonder how many of you know what that is. The documentary hypothesis. It is a hypothesis, which means it is an educated guess. It does not mean it is dogma. It is a hypothesis. But it goes like this. It says that the five books that are attributed to Moses, that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, show evidence of having been derived from four different sources representing different periods of Israelite history. Those sources, if you ever read theological works, especially if you look at some of the works of the higher critics, you will see references to J, E, D, and P. You know what those words, those letters stand for? You know, the J source, the E source, the D source, and the P source. And it may be kind of confusing if you're new to this kind of language, but what it stands for, the J stands for Yahwist. You know, the J meaning Jehovah, Jehovahist, I guess you could say, the Yahwist source. And the assumption there is there's some ancient sect or group of people or whatever who worshipped a god called Yahweh. And so much of what you find in the book of Genesis and in the other four books normally attributed to Moses were derived from the Yahwist source, or apparently there must have been some documents or a document containing information about the worship of Yahweh and how Yahweh made the first man and all of that. We'll get to that a little bit later because we're going to be looking at the creation narrative. The E stands for the Elohist. That's in those texts that you speak that speaks only of God, and God said this and God did that, but it doesn't include the Yahweh. And of course, sometimes there may have been, according to the theory, a merger of the two. So you have Yahweh Elohim, Yahwist and God, Elohim meaning God. And then there's the Deuteronomist, that's the D. And then finally the priestly code, that's the P. This is called the documentary hypothesis. And I've heard this expounded in various formats, read of it in various documents, and have even gone to meetings to hear someone describe it, explain it. In fact, I went to a meeting one time to hear a theologian talk about the documentary hypothesis, about historical critical method in general. That's a method of biblical theology, a method of biblical study that involves trying to get underneath the text and discover what the original sources were. And if you can find that out, then you can find something out about the writer and the concepts that were existing at the time that the documents were written, so you can understand more about how the scriptures were put together. Of course, this tends to rule out the supernatural involvement, doesn't it? It tends to make you think, well, the Bible is just a collection of different documents that were merged together by a group of people down through the centuries, namely the Israelites. And the theory goes like this. The theory is that as time went on through the centuries, that the Israelites came in contact with many other people. Now, remember, the Israelites were these wandering nomads who picked up traditions and customs from other peoples, and they adapted them and adopted them, and they made them their own, and they began to describe their own history in terms of the other cultures. For example, they adopted the feasts of the pagans, the harvest festivals of the pagans. That's what the way the idea goes. They adopted their idea, perhaps the Egyptian idea, of a temple with a holy of holies and animal sacrifices. And they made up the story of the Exodus somewhere along the way. Probably that was an adaptation of an existing theory or an existing idea that came from some pagan source. Now, I'll say up front before I go further that I reject all of that. I reject it completely. I throw it out the window. And I think there is plenty of information, and there are plenty of books refuting all of that. But I was listening one night to an individual, a theologian, expounding this. And he was saying, in Genesis chapter 6, there was no boat. He was saying that the earth is much older than the book of Genesis says that it is. And I thought, well, how old does the book of Genesis say the earth is? I can't remember reading a text in Genesis, a passage in Genesis, saying that the earth is a certain age. I know of theories stating how old people think the earth is based upon certain genealogical records and so on, which are not always complete, by the way. Some people who thought that Adam was created 6,000 years ago and look at the genealogical records in Scripture, and they come to find out that sometimes son of means great, 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 great grandson of. So there are big gaps in the genealogical records. And so it may be that Adam was created 10,000 years ago. And I'm inclined to think that that's closer to it. But I'll get to that a little bit later when we talk about the creation narrative. But in any case, the one theologian, fortunately there was room for questions and answers, and I could not resist when he made the comment that there was no boat in Genesis 6 because you can't get blue whales on a boat. And I said, why would he want to put blue whales on a boat? They would survive in the water. And he went on to say, referred to Genesis 6:19, it says, every living creature, that's what it says. Now this was after he roundly condemned fundamentalism. Fundamentalism meaning that approach to Scripture where you take things literally. You read the text, it says that there was a boat, you believe there was a boat. It says that Noah built it, you believe Noah built it. It says there was a flood, you believe there was a flood. It says they brought animals aboard the ark, it doesn't say that there were grown animals, does it? Could have been little baby animals, probably were. But you believe it, so you take it literally. So this person was saying, you know, the fundamentalists, they're all mixed up. You don't take any of that literally. But you know what he did? You know what he did? In order to dismiss it as a myth, he interpreted that passage, Genesis 6, verse 19, in a hyper-literalistic fashion. And I couldn't resist it. I said, well, that's fundamentalism. And he said, yeah, you're right. He didn't know I was insulting him. I was telling him, look, what you're doing, you are interpreting the text according to fundamentalist principles in order to dismiss it as myth. But in any case, it's just fun when you deal with some of those things. But in any case, that's in essence the documentary hypothesis, the idea that the different sources, there are different sources underlying the text. In Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. I want to give you an example of that now. In Genesis chapter 1, I'm just going to go through quickly, not read whole verses, but just fragments of verses to show you what I mean. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning, God, the word is Elohim, God. It doesn't say Yahweh, it just says God. So it is assumed, as we're going to see, because Genesis 1 uses the term Elohim, translated here God, over and over and over again, then it is assumed that the Elohist source is primarily responsible for this part of the text. It goes on to say, and God said, verse 3, verse 4, and God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. Verse 5, God, Elohim, called the light day. Verse 6, then Elohim said, let there be a firmament. Verse 7, then God made the firmament. All the way through this chapter, if you just read through it, you'll notice that over and over and over that the word God is there. God did this, God said that, God made this and that and the other thing, and God said it was very good. And God said, let us make man in our image. But there's a change here that you will notice when you come to chapter 2. In chapter 2, it continues on, verse 1 continues, verse 2 and 3 says, God, or Elohim, made the seventh day. He rested on the seventh day. He blessed the seventh day. But notice something here in verse 4 of chapter 2. This is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that Yahweh, Elohim, made the earth and the heavens. Yahweh is used here. And then in verse 5, again, the latter part of the verse, for Yahweh, Elohim, had not caused it to rain and so on. And so from henceforth, you see, Yahweh is used. So the idea is that from verse 4 onward, the primary underlying source of the writers, not writer, singular, meaning Moses, but probably a number of writers who contributed to it, and that's another thing that's always brought up, that Moses didn't write these things, but it was a number of other writers. I say Moses did write. At least, what Mosaic authorship means is simply that Moses was a primary contributor to the text. That's why it's called the Law of Moses. That's why the writings are attributed to Moses. We're going to look at some scriptures a little bit later to show that Jesus Christ himself, and that ought to be good enough for any of us, attributed these writings to Moses. So he was a primary contributor to. These have substantial Mosaic authorship, put it that way. But here, according to the documentary hypothesis, chapter 2, beginning with verse 4, begins the Yahwist source, which is supposed to be, I say, you know, is supposedly, not that it's supposed to be in the sense that we use that, it is supposedly older than the first creation account. It's said that these are two creation, two conflicting, and I've heard theologians say it, that these two creation narratives conflict with each other, and that the Yahwist source in chapter 2 is older than the Elohist source in chapter 1. Well, when I read it, I don't see any conflict. What I do see in chapter 2 is that there's more attention to the detail. He's simply coming back, the writer is coming back, and he's talking about with more detail what God did on the sixth day described in chapter 1. He created man, and it tells how he created man, male and female. So it's not a conflicting. You see, again, here again, the critics, the form critics, the higher critics, those who adopt the historical critical method as their method of interpretation, tend to read everything in this hyper-literalistic sense and then go back and say, well, you see, it contradicts. They don't give the writer any benefit of writing in the normal expressions of his day, just as you and I would. You know, if somebody got a hold of something that I wrote, it would be easy to find things that they say contradict. In fact, sometimes they have done that, and unfortunately, sometimes they're right. But nevertheless, C.S. Lewis said one time that when people start to analyze his writings, and then he looks at what they have said about him and his underlying currents or sources or whatever, he says they don't get it right. How in the world could these people possibly get into the mind of these ancient writers and determine that there's a Yahwist source and an Elohist source and all these other sources underlying the text, and that Moses didn't do it? It's impossible. That's why it's called a hypothesis. Oh, by the way, the one theologian was saying that these things are incontrovertible. He was bragging on the old German theologians of the 19th century, I guess, who started coming up with some of these things. And he was saying how many of the modern theologians, those that followed in the 20th century, it took them so long to catch up. And these things were proven incontrovertible. And I thought, if it's so incontrovertible, why is it called a documentary hypothesis? You know, that means it's guesswork. But anyway, continuing on with the thought, the previous thought, and that is that the Genesis 2 account, there are some other explanations, you know. There are some other explanations. I'm going to take a shot at it. Now, this is me. It's not something I got from somebody else. I'm just thinking about it. Why is it in chapter 2 that all of a sudden he begins using the word Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton, Jehovah, whatever it's pronounced, but Yah, we'll say Yahweh. It's the word Lord in the King James Version in all caps. Why is it that he talks about God did this, God did that, and all these other things, and all of a sudden it's Yahweh God? I think I'll offer an explanation. And it has to do with what the name Yahweh meant. And I hope nobody thinks that we're headed towards sacred names. We are not. Get that clear. We're not. But Yahweh was... What does the name mean? Many would say, well, it means the eternal. It talks about the eternal nature of God. I think it does. But more than that, it also talks about his eternal faithfulness in covenant relationship with his people. That's what the name signifies. And here, what has God just done? On the sixth day, he made man. Then he rested. What does that rest signify? Entering fellowship with his creation, man. And then he goes back and reiterates now, and he's talking about, in more detail in chapter 2, the creation of man, and the man and the man, meaning Adam, meaning the man and the woman, humankind is what it means. In talking in more detail, he uses a term that expresses covenant relationship. You see, covenant has to do with relationship, and when you're talking about God and mankind, you're talking about familial relationship ultimately. So I believe that's the reason that the word Yahweh is used here. It's not derived from two pagan sources, the Yahweh worshippers and the Elohim worshippers. Some have even gone so far as to say that those who worship Elohim, the word Elohim being plural, originally were polytheists, who worshiped multiple gods. And now this is being applied to the one God, Yahweh. No, that's not true at all. It's just there's no evidence to support that. And by the way, nobody has ever found any of these texts that supposedly underlie the books attributed to Moses. Okay. Well, I'd like to move on now to something else, and that's Mosaic authorship. Let me quickly go through some scriptures to just establish what Scripture itself says about Mosaic authorship. In Exodus chapter 24, I understand once again that, as I said earlier, when we talk about Mosaic authorship, we're not saying that Moses wrote every word, because you'll notice at the end of Deuteronomy it tells about Moses' death. He obviously didn't write about his own death. Somebody had to add that to the story, some other writer. Now, there's no problem with that. We're talking about substantial Mosaic authorship when we're talking about these five books, that everything here is based upon what God gave to Moses, what was revealed to him. In Exodus chapter 24, verse 1, now he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, and at you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him." So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has said, we will do." Now then, if we believe that these words of the law did not come from God through Moses, then we do not believe this text, do we? We do not believe this text. We're told here that Moses was the one God used in revealing his law to his people. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And verse 7 says, then he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has said we will do and be obedient." So here you already had some substantial documentation going on in the time of Moses. He had already written a significant amount. So it's not as if these stories were compiled and written much later. Moses himself here is described as having contributed significantly to what is written herein. In Exodus chapter 34, I'm not going to read all of these. Another reference, though, is Exodus 34, verses 27 and 29. Also, in the time of Joshua, after Moses, let me just make a reference, Joshua chapter 8, verse 32, if anybody who happens to be taking notes or wanted to look it up while we're going through this, Joshua chapter 8, verse 32, you see very clearly that it was understood from those times that Moses wrote these things. And then the most important thing, though, is what Jesus Christ himself says. In Mark chapter 7, let's read a few scriptures from the New Testament before going on. In Mark chapter 7, and in verse 10, and I'm just going to read these right out of the, I'm not going to take time to go into the context, just read the verse as it stands. Jesus says, verse 10, "For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father and mother, let him be put to death." You go back, you read that in what is called the Law of Moses. It's within those first five books of the Bible. Jesus says, Moses said it. In Mark chapter 10, over a few pages, Mark chapter 10, beginning in verse 3, "And he answered and said to them, what did Moses command you?" This was on the question of marriage and divorce. "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and to dismiss her." And Jesus answered and said to them, "Because of the hardness of your heart, he," meaning Moses, "wrote you this precept." In Mark chapter 12 and verse 26, again, Jesus says, "But concerning the dead, that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush passage, how God spoke to him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob?" So, and there are many others. There's in Luke and John, I'm not going to go through all these. If you'll just take a concordance, look up the word Moses, where in all the places it appears in the New Testament, you will see that again and again and again, Jesus and Paul and others attribute to Moses the writings that we call the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. So there is substantial Mosaic authorship there according to Scripture itself. Now, when you start dismantling that, you see what's happening, don't you? You're dismantling the very Word of God. You're taking the underpinnings right out from under the faith. What do you have left if you dismantle that, the words of Jesus himself? Well, he didn't really know what he was talking about. Is that what we're going to say? It's apparently some people think that that's exactly the case. He didn't know. I say he probably knew. No, I say he definitely knew a little bit better than even the higher critics. But now then, well, all of this information, the point I'm leading to is this. The subject today has to do with the creation narrative. But once you replace substantial Mosaic authorship with the documentary hypothesis and add a little bit of evolutionary theory to the mix, then inevitably the allegorical interpretation, which means essentially that many of the accounts of Scripture, such as the creation narrative, the account of the flood, the account of Balaam and his talking donkey, and all of these other things, these sometimes miraculous and strange things, including the Exodus and many other things, suddenly become myth. They become mere stories or parables through which the person telling the story, or the many writers, the many authors telling the stories with their pagan backgrounds, the mythical backgrounds, are trying to tell you some kind of spiritual lesson. That's what it is reduced to. It is no longer history. It's all parabolic. And so this is a problem. And this is what has happened to the creation narrative. The first chapter in particular of the Bible. Now, we're going to go back there, but before we read through certain parts of this text, I want to just give you an overview, a general overview of the creation narrative. On day one, God makes the light shine in the darkness. On day two, God made the firmament, called heaven, to separate the waters. There are waters up there and waters down below. And there's a firmament in the middle. I call that the atmosphere. Day three, God gathered the waters and made the dry land appear. You know, in Scripture, the way it's worded, the gathering of the waters. It means they were gathered into a place. It says that the gathering of the waters, that was called the seas, and the dry land appeared. That's where humankind would flourish, and where the animals that don't dwell in the sea would flourish. And then he caused the earth to bring forth grass and trees and herbs, in other words, botanical life forms on that day. That's day three. Day four, now this is a problem text here, and we'll take a look at it more closely later. But it says that God made the sun, the moon, and the stars. He made the light to appear, however, in verse 1, and on the first day. How is that that you have light shining through into what was formerly darkness, formerly bohu and tohu, chaos and confusion, as we've heard so many times? How is it that light was shining, and yet here we read, we seem to read on day four that he made the sun, the moon, and the stars? We'll talk about that a little bit later. On day five, God made the animals. And then on day six, God made man. Then in chapter two, you have a little more detailed description of God's creating or making man and how he went about doing that. Now, there are several different views of creation. And let me say up front that I know that this is one of the most sensitive areas you could possibly get into. People, anytime they read from anybody's publications a view of creation that is contrary to their own, they get angry. They get upset. If you think that the days of Genesis, for example, the days of Genesis 1, are anything other than 24-hour days, people get upset about that. On the other hand, if you say they are 24-hour days, the people who think that they represent long ages get upset about that. And so everybody gets upset about everybody else. Let me say up front, this is not a salvation issue. If you differ from the opinion I'm going to express today, then that's fine. You may be right, and somewhere along the way I may be wrong. But look, just briefly, before I express what I think, which, by the way, is in agreement with what I think most of us have believed for many years, but before I express that, I'd like to go through the major theories of Genesis 1, of creation. First of all, there is what is called young earth creationism or young universe creationism. I mentioned this earlier. It's the belief that the universe came into existence about 5 days before Adam came into existence. In other words, on the sixth day when Adam was made, the universe had just leapt into existence by God's divine command. I don't think anybody in here would deny that God is capable of doing that. Certainly he's capable of doing it. And there are some parts of the theory, this particular view, that I feel are plausible. In chapter 1, in verse 1, here's basically the way it's put together. In chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Now, it's pointed out by young earth creationists that this word was, I read a whole book on the word was, and it tells you what was is. But the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Now, we've always said that this word was means became, or can be translated became. I think it can be, but it's not necessary to translate it became. And I'll get to that later when I get to the view that I want to put forth, which is the one I personally hold, and I feel that is within keeping with a literal reading of the text. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. All this has happened now, it said, in an instant, within the first 24 hours. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And then it goes on down to verse 5, said that this was the first day. So the young earth creationists would say, all of this, everything that's described from verse 1 down to verse 5, happened within a 24-hour period. The universe leapt into existence. The earth was here. It was at first in a state called here without form and void, meaning it was a lifeless state. It was a desolate wilderness, as it were, covered with water and under darkness. And then God says, let there be light. All that on day one. Now, there are a lot of problems that you run into along the way, and I think the young earth creationists have some fairly plausible answers. For example, you have the question of dinosaurs. What happened to the dinosaurs? And most would say, well, they died in the flood. And others would say that, well, dinosaurs were carried aboard the ark. Or some of them, some dinosaurs, remember, could survive in the water. Actually, they dwelt in the water. And they survived in the water. And the truth is, you do find dinosaurs after the flood. I'm not talking about the great dinosaurs. I'm not talking about T-Rex. No, he would have taken care of everything on the ark, I'm sure. But I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about the great, you know, the ones you see in Jurassic Park, the ones whose bones have been dug up and we realize that these creatures were really giants. We're talking about much smaller versions of those, such as the plesiosaur. You ever heard of the plesiosaur, the plesiosaurus? Or the pterodactyl. Apparently those have continued to exist, and even, believe it or not, this thing may seem hard to believe, but I think it's plausible. I think there's a plausible explanation for the many sightings of the Loch Ness Monster, for example. You know, there have been thousands of such sightings. If there's one or two people who were out and had a little bit too much to drink, said they saw a dinosaur in the lake, I would say, well, okay. You know, I obviously wouldn't believe it. But thousands of people have seen the same thing. Again and again and again, and they have even seen it on dry land. And the description is the same. And the scientists, the ones who look at it, and many of them dismiss it because they say, oh, the dinosaurs are extinct. And the plesiosaur, unfortunately, got labeled dinosaur when they dug up some bones of the thing somewhere along the way. But I think the Loch Ness Monster is probably a plesiosaurus. And I think that the Erie Lake Monster, you know, there was one of those, is also one of the same. And the one that the Japanese fishermen pulled out of the sea, a dead one, that they was stunk so bad they had to throw it back. They said it was not any kind of shark that they're familiar with or anything like that. It was had a long neck, about 20 feet long, I think. One washed ashore. Heard about one that washed ashore in California. One sighted down at Panama City. They've been sighted out at sea. They've been seen. They're certainly in Africa, in a vast wilderness area in the heart of Africa. that's largely unexplored. The natives there, you show them a picture, and I say, yeah, let's tell you the name of it. Not plesiosaur, they have another name for it, obviously. They even said they killed and ate one, and people who ate it died. Don't know if it's poisonous or whether it's just got a hold of some bad meat or what. Anyway, these things have been seen, and there are thousands of eyewitnesses, so I can't deny that. It's probably, some scientists have said, it is probably a plesiosaur, and the thing survived. And pterodactyls, not as big as you see in Jurassic Park or some of the old movies, you know, when the huge giant thing swoops down and picks up a grown man. But those things have been seen in the Americas. They've been seen in Europe and other parts of the world. And they're smaller now. Some of them are pretty big, 20-foot wingspan. But they have the long beak with the teeth and all of that. And so I can understand how the young Earth creationists could get all excited about those things and say, hey, the dinosaurs didn't die out at all. Some of them survived the flood, especially those that could live in the water. And apparently they did. But none of the big ones. No T-Rex. Nobody claims that there's anything like that roaming the Earth today. You know, what it really comes down to is that scientists have labeled certain creatures dinosaurs. And when people see them, they say, hey, the dinosaurs are still alive. And in effect, that's true. But it's not all that big a deal because they're really not as dangerous as some of the other animals we have with us. You know, lions, tigers, even the hippos and rhinos and things like that. But anyway, there are apparently dinosaurs roaming the earth today. And then also other information such as what happened when Mount St. Helens blew up and the aftermath of that, we discovered that things can happen much more quickly than we thought. And it seems that there's evidence as a result of that that possibly the Grand Canyon theory that we've always held, that it took thousands and thousands of years to form, could have happened very quickly following the flood. And I think that's it's plausible. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with it. I wasn't there at the flood, and I don't know. I didn't see it as it happened. But I'm saying that it at least appears plausible to me. And then you say, people ask, though, but what about the great distances between from the stars? You know, we know now that there are stars out there that are billions of light years away. And it requires that many years for light to reach the Earth. Now, the light has reached the Earth, otherwise we wouldn't be seeing them. I mean, we can see distant galaxies. And we can see things, the nearest star is, what, 4.5 light years away? It takes 4.5 years for light to get here. That's the nearest. That's our close neighbor. In the cosmic neighborhood, I mean, we're just like that, you know, we in Alpha Centauri. But you look overall at this galaxy alone, let alone many other galaxies that are out there, you're talking about billions of light years, and the light has already reached the Earth, so the Earth must have been here, or at least the universe must have been around, for billions of years. That seems plausible, doesn't it? Well, the young Earth creationists would come back and say, well, did God create Adam as a baby? No, he was a full-grown man. So he also created a mature universe. The light was already reaching the Earth when he made the universe. And I was like, okay, I can't prove it. I wasn't there. I can't dismiss that and say, absolutely, it is not so. However, I can say I am not convinced of it. Not at all. Now, then there are other theories. For example, the one we hold, by the way, or we traditionally hold, is the gap theory. I think a modified form of the traditional classic gap theory, but nevertheless, I'll come back to that later. And there's the day-age theory, also known as the geological age, or progressive creationism, or process creationism. And according to this particular view of Genesis 1, the Hebrew word translated day is the word yom. And if you look up that word in the concordance and go through and see how it is used, you see that it does not always refer to a 24-hour period. Sometimes it refers to a long period of time. Classic example, the day of the Lord. Does that mean the 24-hour day of the Lord? Or are we talking about a period of time that may take in several days or even years? Well, we're talking about a period of time. In fact, there have been many days of the Lord in Israel's history, many days in which God's wrath was poured out, and there's coming a future day of the Lord, and we've always said that that will require some years. In fact, that we have said at times that the day of the Lord takes in not only the period of final judgment and wrath of God, but also the millennium, a whole age. So the day-age theory sees the days of creation, the days of Genesis 1, as symbolic of or representing ages, long ages, in which God caused these things to form and slowly take shape. And I go on to point out that words for morning and evening simply mean the closing and the dawning. The closing of one age, the dawning of a new. And I have to say, when I read, for example, the works of Dr. Hugh Ross, who is a progressive creationist, a scientist, but who does believe in God and has a ministry going on, Reasons to Believe is the name of his ministry. But he does present what I would say a plausible explanation of the day-age theory. And he's simply saying that the writer is using ordinary terms, morning, evening, day, and so forth, these descriptions, to symbolize what actually happened over ages or geological periods. And he's able to align the succession of geological periods or ages with the days of creation. And it seems plausible. I tend to doubt it, but it is plausible. So I have to give credit to a lot of these folks. They come up with some plausible. Sometimes I hear a theory, and when I first hear it, I reject it. No, that can't be. But then when I look at it, and I think, well, now wait a minute. I kind of understand where they're coming from. But again, I don't say that I accept the theory. I just acknowledge that at least there is a certain degree of plausibility about it. Now, by the way, day-age theorists do not necessarily believe in evolution. Dr. Hugh Ross believes that there was a literal Adam, a literal Eve, man was created in the sixth geological age. And so therefore, you know, it's fairly, shall we say, orthodox in the sense that there's no dependency at all upon evolution. Then there's another one called the punctuated day theory. Has anyone heard of that? The punctuated day theory. And it goes like this, that the days of creation in Genesis 1 are literal days, but what the text doesn't tell you is they're separated by millions of years. The punctuated day theory. So day one was day one of God's intervention into this process that he started, perhaps with the Big Bang. And by the way, the day-age theorists tend to believe in the Big Bang, not in the evolutionary sense, but that God caused the Big Bang. That's how he formed the universe. And the same is true with the punctuated day theory. It allows for evolution, but does not necessarily demand it. So you have millions of years lapsing between the days, which are literal days, and those days simply represent God's intervention. In fact, some translations would tend to support the day-age theory. For example, some of the modern English translations in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 5, where it says the first day in this one, says one day in others. So you have one day, later on, maybe a couple million years, you have the second day, the third day, and so forth. So you see how the theory goes, the punctuated day theory. And then there's the framework theory. And I can best describe it by relating it to a vacation, for example. Suppose you and your family go on a vacation. And what do you do when you go on a vacation so that you can later recall and remember? Well, you take pictures, don't you? So you take pictures. You go through a certain area. You stop. You go to the various, scenic route, and you go to all the attractions, and you take pictures. You get your family to stand out there at the signs, and you take pictures. And then you take a bunch of more pictures when you get someplace else. And as you travel further, you take more pictures. And you get back home, what do? You put those pictures in an album. And you have them categorized. So this is when we were in New Mexico. Now this was when we were in Colorado. We were in the Rocky Mountains here, and this is this beautiful whatever scenic attraction. But the thing is, the pictures do not necessarily represent a sequence. They do not tell you the details of the travel. They just tell you that you traveled, that you've been there. And some, those who hold to the framework theory, believe that the days of creation represent the various acts of creation that God was involved in, but not necessarily in sequence. Of course, the problem is that is this presented in sequence. Day one, day two, day three, and so forth. So that one is quite problematic. And even though it's attractive in a way, it leaves too many big gaps. Talk about a gap theory. Now, there's your gap theory. And then finally, there is theistic evolution. Theistic evolution. And I would say that if it were not for the influences in my life, I would tend to believe this one. And that is the belief that, well, actually, the influence of since in my life would probably help me to believe it because, you know, I went to university where I got a head full of evolution. And that was a problem. It's hard to deal with. But the idea is that Genesis 1 is an imaginary week. It's a myth. An imaginary week designed to reveal the who, the what, and to some extent the why, but not the how. And what this means is that dust from which Adam was created could have been a group of hominids, you know, pre-Homo sapiens, you know, they're made of the same elements of the earth. In other words, it was living matter, and some have actually said that. Well, that dust of the earth, what that means, it was living matter from which Adam came. And what was Adam? Well, Adam was a whole class of hominids. And what happened then? What does the Genesis account tell us? Well, it's just a myth adopted from pagan cultures, probably. But what it really tells us, the real revelation underlying all the myth, is that God intervened in the process, you know, after he caused the Big Bang for 4 billion years earlier, or 4.5 billion or whatever, and after the universe spread out, and he kind of left it alone, maybe manipulating here and there a little bit. And then finally he intervened when the single-cell organisms finally became multi-cell organisms, and then complex organisms with a complexity of organs, and finally developed into these pre-human type creatures. Then he finally intervenes, and he gives these creatures, a whole class of them, not just one, but a whole class of them, a spirit or soul. And he sets them apart from the other creatures. And all this takes place over, you know, a few million years. And that's a very popular theory these days. It's theistic evolution. And again, it emphasizes that the Genesis account, both so-called creation, conflicting creation accounts, chapter 1 and chapter 2, are mythical and are simply symbolic. So those are your basic views, but I want to come back to the one that I mentioned, the gap theory. And again, this is my opinion. This is my opion, and I think it... I'm going to read a portion of the book of Genesis, or chapter 1 of Genesis, look at some other scriptures also that relate to this. And I think that the position that we have advocated over the years, for the most part, is the most plausible. And again, that's my opinion. That's my opinion. But I want to notice some things that the book of Genesis, chapter 1, does not say. First of all, chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." We know that that's true. Everybody agrees to that. Well, most everybody agrees to that. God created the heavens and the earth. The earth, verse 2, was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. What does this not tell us? It does not tell us how long the earth was in the state of being void and formless. You know what that expression means? Tohu and bohu, you know what it means? Well, there are some examples in Scripture. Let's look at some of them in Isaiah chapter 24. Now, this is not talking about creation. Nevertheless, it gives us some idea as to what these terms mean and what they meant to the Hebrews. In Isaiah chapter 24, verse 1, "Behold, the Lord makes the earth empty and makes it waste." That's what it means. And he's talking about here the impending judgment upon the earth. It says, "distorts its surface and scatters abroad its inhabitants." Now then let's look at chapter 34. Chapter 34. We'll see the same expression used. The words tohu and bohu. Chapter 34. Verse 11 says, but the pelican and the porcupine shall possess it. It's talking about the land when he brings judgment upon the land. Also the owl and the raven shall dwell in it, and he shall stretch out over it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. Same expression once again, or similar expression. So here, this is, you notice here though that the owl and the raven are still there in this empty land that is tohu and bohu. The emptiness and the state of that is described here still has some life there. So the point is that you're simply describing, when you're talking about emptiness and the state of being void, when the scriptures talks about that from the Hebrew point of view, it's just simply talking about a wasteland. I will turn the land into a wasteland. So back in the book of Genesis in chapter 1, the earth was a wasteland. It could be translated became a wasteland, but it was a wasteland. In fact, if it's not fit for human life, it is tohu and bohu. Even if there are great dinosaurs at some point, such as the T-Rex and other flesh-eating dinosaurs that we wouldn't stand a chance against, especially in that, without the weapons we have today, we could probably take care of them. But back then, you know, it's doubtful. And that would have been a state of tohu and bohu, a state of emptiness, because it would have not been a climate, a condition, an environment where human life could flourish. One other scripture in Jeremiah chapter 4. And again, my only point in pointing these scriptures, realizing they're not talking about creation, but they do give us some idea as to the meaning of tohu and bohu. Chapter 4, Jeremiah, verse 23, says, I beheld the earth, and indeed it was without form and void. Now, in context, he's talking about the doom of a nation. And the heavens, they had no night, or no light. I beheld the mountains, and indeed they trembled. And all the hills moved back and forth. I beheld, and indeed there was no man. And all the birds of the heavens had fled. I beheld, and indeed the fruitful land was a wilderness. So the earth was in a wilderness-type condition. And Genesis 1 tells us that the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. We're later told that the land was separated from the waters. So evidently, the deep, or the waters, covered the whole surface of the earth. The second important point here is to realize that this is not told from the point of view of somebody looking down at the earth from a spacecraft. We always see these images of a shuttlecraft or some kind of craft out there, maybe a satellite or whatever, showing images of the earth. They didn't think in these terms. The earliest readers didn't think of that at all. So this is told from the point of view of someone familiar with the land, with the earth. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the deep, not out in space, but over the face of the deep. So that's important to keep in mind, that this whole account is told from that point of view. Again, what this does not tell us, it does not say how long the earth was in this state of being without form and void and having darkness and all this water. It's no, we're not told. To say that we know is to theorize. It could have been millions of years, or it could have been 24 hours. We don't know, do we? But I think it's plausible, and certainly within keeping to the literalistic approach to interpreting the scriptures, to say, and especially looking at science, what we know through science, it is plausible to at least theorize that this condition of formlessness and shapelessness, or being void, unsuitable for life, especially human life, could have persisted for many, many long centuries and even millions of years. That's plausible. The text does not tell us otherwise. Then it goes on to say, notice what it says. After it says in verse 2 that the earth was without form and void and darkness was on the face of the deep, it says, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. It doesn't say when this began. Could have been right away, as soon as, you know, the universe leapt into existence, or it could have been after millions of years of being into this, in this state. says, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Now, you have to go back to verse 1 where it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth, that means the universe, was created. Then, after the creation, the Spirit is seen here hovering over the face of the waters. And the earth is in this state of tohu and bohu. And then we're told that God said, let there be light. And there was light. And I want to ask you this question. Does this say that God created the light at this point? Well, if he created the heavens and the earth back in verse 1, and at some point after the creation of the heavens and the earth, the Spirit is hovering over the waters, and then God says, let there be light, then apparently light already existed. Otherwise, you don't have heavens and earth, because the universe is made up of energy. And this matter right here is just a different form of energy. So the lights were already there. The stars were already there. I say that the sun was already there by the time the Spirit is seen here hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. It means that light now comes through the darkness. Possibly, in the state of being void and without form, the earth under darkness had a thick veil, perhaps of dust, thick dust, kicked up by an incoming, collision with a huge meteor, an asteroid. And some feel that did happen, and there's some evidence that it did. Some think that's what happened to the large dinosaurs that possibly existed millions of years ago. So this condition that the earth was in could have been that way for many, many, many centuries or even millions of years. But now God begins to take action, and he causes light to come into the picture. Now light reaches the surface. It reaches the water. And this simply means, as we shall see as we move along, that this opaque condition now becomes translucent. It does not say that God created the light at that moment. It just says that the light, he said, let there be light, and the light came through the darkness. So he saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. And it goes on to talk about the firmament. We're not going to go through all of this. We do have a tape on the subject called The Days of Creation. It's probably more detailed than what we're going to do today, but I just wanted to touch on the theories and then show what I feel to be the most plausible of all. You have the second day, the third day, and so forth. You have the earth, the vegetation beginning to appear. And I don't think that means that all of a sudden grown trees just appeared. I think it means that the seeds were planted, that the potential was placed in the earth, and those things, the grass and the herbs and the trees, began to grow. And of course, as Scripture often does, it looks out beyond that beginning and sees the time when they will be full grown. Also think that the Garden of Eden was a special creation, that God did create it mature and put Adam in it. Otherwise, what would he do for food? He had to wait till everything grows and all of that sort of thing. No, he had he had a special environment created just for him and for Eve. So the Garden of Eden was special, I believe. And it goes on to describe these things. Now then after that, we come on down to the fourth day, and this is where we have some problems. Verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. Again, what does this, so far, just this verse alone, these two verses alone, what do they not tell us? They do not tell us that God created the lights for the first time, does it? He just says, let there be lights from the point of view of the earth, person looking at it from the earth. Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens. In other words, look up and see lights. In other words, this translucent condition of the atmosphere was now transformed. And this is theoretical. The text doesn't say it, but I'm just pointing out a way of understanding. Translucence becomes transparent. now you can see the stars that were there back in verse 1. They're already there. Now, the problem comes with the latter part, but there is an explanation for this as well. That's in verse 16. This translation says, "Then God made two great lights." The better rendering is, leave off the "then." It's just simply, "God made two great lights," or "and God made two great lights." Some of yours probably have "and," or maybe leave off the "and." God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. Now, wait a minute. This is day 4. Didn't we read that back earlier? To divide the light from the darkness? That's what he did in verse 4. On the first day, God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. The light and darkness are already divided. So why here on day 4 is he saying that God put these two great lights, obviously talking about the sun and the moon, to divide the day from the night? Why does it say that? You see, verse 16 and 17, and the Hebrew does allow for this. You can check various commentators and whatnot. The Hebrew allows for this, and that is that this is not saying what God made on the fourth day. It is telling the purpose for God's having made these to start with on the first day, or actually causing them to appear on the first day. See, this was his original purpose, to divide the darkness from the light. And also, something else, to give signs for the seasons of the year. And with a translucent atmosphere, you can't do that. With a transparent atmosphere, you can. So now then, in other words, the whole collection of verses here from verse 14 through 18 really tells us that, and now on the fourth day, or I'm saying really tells us, I'm sorry, again, this is my opinion, which I feel is plausible one, the most plausible explanation, is that God's original purpose for the sun and the moon were to rule the day and the night, the stars were for the seasons of the year, and they used to give light on the earth at night. Now they can fulfill their purpose because the atmosphere is transformed from translucent to transparent. Do you follow what I'm trying to say here? In other words, verse 16 does not mean that God created those lights on that day. And the Hebrew allows for the explanation I'm giving. And it goes on to say the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And then on the fifth day you have the great sea creatures and the moving things on the earth and the winged birds and so forth. And then finally on the sixth day you have the pinnacle of God's creation. And this is what it's all leading to. And that's the creation of man. So I would take these 6 days, I tend to take them and believe that the most plausible view would take them as 6 literal days. It does say the morning and the evening, or the evening and the morning. And while loosely that can be interpreted to mean the closing of an age and the dawning of a new age, in the context here, talking about separating light from darkness, you're talking about the revolution of the earth. You're talking about 24-hour days, roughly 24 hours, a rotating night and darkness and light. And taking it literally, I think these are 6 literal 24-hour days. And you go to Exodus 20 and read the wording of the Sabbath commandment. It says, "For God made the heavens and the earth in 6 days. And there's another thing about that. Our young earth creationists often use that verse and others similar to it to show that, you see, God created everything in 6 days. Ex nihilo. He brought it into existence from nothing. And this happened within that week, within the 6 days. Well, you know, there are other scriptures that speak of a new creation. It speaks of the abolition of the old and of the coming of a new creation. But the arrival of the new creation, remember what we read in Romans 8 about the new creation? About how this present creation groans in travail, seeking the appearance, or looking for the appearance of the sons of God. In other words, a transformation of nature. So the new creation of the future is really a transformation of the old creation. Therefore, based on that principle, we might as well conclude, or we can conclude, and I think fairly, that The creation account described here is a transformation of the existing creation, which may go back 4.5 billion years. We just don't know. A lot of people have a problem with that because they think, well, what did God do in all that time? You have to realize that God does not relate to time as you and I do. 1,000 years is as a day, and a day is 1,000 years. There's not much difference between them. God does not dwell in the universe. He is extra universal. He is outside. He is above. He is beyond the universe. The universe did not exist. God did. In fact, the universe, you know, when you start looking at science and you look at the universe, even if there was a Big Bang, and I'm not going to say there wasn't, that God didn't use one. He could have. I'm not saying that he did. I don't know. But he could have. But you know what the Big Bang theory really says? It really upholds the existing laws as we understand them of physics, which means ultimately that there can be no eternal regression of cause and effect in the material world. In other words, there is no eternity, past eternity of matter. It had to come into existence. That means that if the Big Bang theory is correct, well, whether it's correct or not, but the point is the Big Bang theory does support the idea, and scientists know it, many scientists know it, that there had to have been a first cause. God, therefore, is necessary. There could not have been a universe without a first cause that exists outside the realm of cause and effect motion of which this universe is composed. So when it comes down to it, you may disagree with my theory, the theory I hold and think is the most plausible, but when it comes down to it, we agree on the most essential thing, I think, and that is that in the beginning, God created.